This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. In this portion of the program, we're going to take a look at the evolution of public life in America from the colonial period to the present. Where are we today? How did we get here? And where are we headed? As Iowans prepare to caucus this evening, we'll talk with historian Morton Keller about his new book, America's Three Regimes, A New Political History. Morton Keller, a professor of history emeritus at Brandeis University, says a history of American public life is, quote, as much about continuity, persistence, and evolution as about change, transformation, and revolution. He says the subject of his book is the American polity, that is, not only politics, but law and government as well, with other forces, other institutions, business, media, and advocacy groups also playing a role. Professor Keller sees our history in terms of three long regimes: deferential Republican, and that Republican is with a lowercase r, from colonial times to the 1820s, Party Democratic, and that's a lowercase d in that word democratic, from the 1830s to the 1930s and the current period. Populist Bureaucratic, from the 30s to the present. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. You can join the discussion with your questions and comments. I look forward to your telephone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Morton Keller is Spector Professor of History Emeritus at Brandeis University. He's the author or editor of many books and articles on American history. Professor Keller is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and a corresponding fellow of the British Academy. His latest book, America's Three Regimes, A New Political History, is published by Oxford University Press. And again, those telephone numbers, 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Professor Keller, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hello.
Hi. How are you?
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes. Well, let's begin with the word regime. Why the word regime, and how do you define a regime?
Well, most historians and political scientists talk about party periods, and or they even talk about shorter times, like the Age of Jackson or the Progressive Era, ages and eras that turn out to be about 10 years long. And I was struck, as I thought over American politics, a subject I've been teaching through my career, by really how long and persistent the dominant styles of politics are, and how much it takes to really significantly change them. So I thought the word regime, which is used primarily to describe, for instance, the old regime in Europe before the French Revolution, caught this quality of persistence over time better than party period or ages and eras that we talk of, that we apply to such things as the Jackson time or the Progressive period.
Yeah. Now, in the introduction to your book, you say each regime wrestled with issues central to the character of its public life. What have been the core issues for each period?
Well, I think the core issue for the colonial and period and the early republic was the evolution of a people who came with all kinds of European ideas, primarily English ideas about hierarchy and social structure and the role of authority and power, and who were forced to think differently about these things by the peculiar conditions of American life. So you have a 200-year period of evolution. The revolution doesn't just come out of the imperial crisis of the late 18th century. It builds on generations of experience that were increasingly peculiar to the Americans. So that the founding fathers, who are, after all, a rather extraordinary group who suddenly appeared on the world scene, were really most of them were from families that had been in America for generations, and they had a whole culture of self-government, of ideas about representative government that really didn't rely very heavily on European models. They often looked for legitimation by quoting European authorities, but what they were coming up with was really an indigenous American experience. And I thought that the evolution of that point of view and its final emergence with the creation of the United States of America at the end of the 18th century was the great theme of the first 200 years of American life.
And it's interesting here to just to talk a little bit more about this period of life, and then we can go maybe and summarize the other two regimes a little bit in terms of the core issues. But it's interesting to think of this first regime in use the words at the same time, deference and revolution.
And Republican.
And republicanism.
Yeah, well, I think it's a kind of evolution of from one to the other. But you could see foreshadowings of republicanism very early in American political life. The early leaders of the first settlements are always complaining that people won't obey authority.
Yeah.
and at the same time, you can see in the early days of the United States, of the Republic, a lot of the old deferential politics. Values and political behavior of the founding fathers often reflected the older, the pre-revolutionary ideas about authority, and it, as they had evolved in the United in America. And so I thought that until really the 1820s, you have a in the early Republic a mix of the new republicanism and the older tradition of deferential politics, which had been brought over from the old country.
Yeah, and then in the late 1820s, we have a move to the what you call the Party Democratic regime.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say it comes abruptly. It takes decades to come. And what struck me was that it only came about as a result of a series of literally world-shaking events, the American Revolution and the Revolutionary War, the creation of the new nation, the rise of the French Revolution and then the struggle with Napoleon, the War of 1812, the release of a new kind of American nationalism, popular nationalism that came with the creation of the nation, the rise of a market economy. It seems to me that all of these things came together to create the ground for a new political regime.
And the issues that the American young American Republic is wrestling with at that point, what were they?
Well, they were basically how do you govern yourself? The principle of self-government was very central to the creation of the United States, but initially, it was hedged in by all kinds of essentially deferential restraints, the Electoral College, the fact that senators were chosen by state legislatures, and the deference that was given to the founding fathers. I mean, the first presidents were either from the Virginia dynasty or they were the Adams family. And that was true from 1790 to 1828. So a lot of the old ways of doing things and thinking about things are there. I tried to show the change that comes by looking at language, at political language. And there it seemed to me the change is very visible. Language and political language in the 18th century was sort of transatlantic. The same words were used on both sides of the Atlantic. Quorum, caucus, which was an American word originally, quickly became an English word as well. There wasn't that much difference in the way in which people talked about public life. Faction, clique, cabal, interest, junto. These are words that are very common in English 18th century politics, and they're very common in American 18th century politics. Then in the early 19th century, there's a separation of the ways. And suddenly you get a terrific infusion of words drawn from everyday life into American politics. Maybe the most common American word, if you can call it that, okay, starts as a political word. And it's a popular political word. It's not handed down by elites. Candidates for Parliament and initially for Congress they stood for office. And in Parliament, of course, they still do. In America, from the 1820s on, they began to run.
Yeah. They haven't stopped.
Right. And they stumped for votes. Yeah. They backed and filled. They bluffed. They dodged the issue. They took a walk. Campaigns got to be very tempestuous, full of booms, landslides, avalanches, prairie fires, tidal waves, stampedes, clean sweeps. Candidates barnstormed. I want to stress how the words come right from the farm, farm life.
Yeah.
They barnstormed on platforms made up of composed of planks. They were dyed-in-the-wool party men. They were dark horses when they didn't have the inside track as a front runner. So it's the racetrack and the farm and, to some degree, poker and gambling that feeds the language of American politics from the 1820s, 30s, 40s, and 50s.
Yeah, so here we have that small-d democratic regime coming in and... The political language is just a beautiful way to see it. Although it, as you make clear, you know, it was really rough and tumble.
Oh yes, it was a very rough and tumble politics, as indeed American life was in the 19th century.
Yeah, and then by way of summing up here, the last period, the current period, populist, bureaucratic. What do you see? We begin with the Great Depression to the present. What are the core issues here in this period?
Yeah, well, once again, I thought it was striking that it took a set of events as cataclysmic in their way as those of the late 18th and early 19th century to create the new political regime in which we live today. It took the Great Depression, World War II, the Cold War, the transformation of American culture and social life after the Second World War. It took all of these things to create a new political culture. Now, what is that culture and what is it all about? Well, it's a response to the demands posed by the Great Depression and then the embroilment of America in foreign affairs, which had been very intermittent for the previous century, but from the late 1930s on has been with us ever since, for 70 to 80 years now. And that, I think, had two consequences. One was that along with the new popular culture, the rise of the media, of the decline of party machines, of patronage, and so on, politics became less defined by parties and more defined by interest groups, advocacy groups, the desires of individuals. Congressmen became more autonomous, as did presidents. You might notice that when presidents debate each other today, or when they speak at conventions when they accept the nomination, they rarely mention the name of their party. Sometimes they don't mention it at all. Mm. Instead, they talk about the issues that concern them. They indulge in what I would call a populist rather than a party-defined politics.
Yeah, they might also compare themselves to a past perceived great president of another party as well.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of Roosevelt, when he first came in, FDR, when he first became president, said, defined himself as a Christian and a Democrat. Now, we see a little of that today in resurgence of religion, in particularly in Republican politics. But for the most part, the politics today is the people who participate in it are sort of independent entrepreneurs. They raise their money more and more through their own devices and don't rely on the parties. They take political stands that reflect their own self-interests and rather than a strong party position. Now, I think along with this has come the demands on government of a continuous American embroilment in international affairs and the rise of a welfare state. So that bureaucracy, a really national state, has come into being. And I think that really started, it began in the New Deal in the 30s, but it really took hold from the 1960s on. So that the level of spending, about three-quarters of American federal spending now goes for domestic purposes. And there was nothing like that in the past. So what we have today is what the political scientist Theodore Lowy calls a new regime, a totally different political system that doesn't rely on parties as it did for 100 years through the 19th and early 20th century, but relies on a strong judiciary, a powerful media, active advocacy groups, and autonomous political leaders. And that really adds up to a new political world in many respects.
Yeah. Also now we have experts in think tanks. That's also part of our current
right
regime.
And you can even see it that in the judiciary. There was a time when a number of the Supreme Court justices were drawn from the cabinet or from the Senate or were governors. And from about the time of Nixon on, that has changed. So since the 1970s, almost every Supreme Court justice is someone who spent most of their career as an appellate court judge. And again, it's become a much more professional branch of government.
Yeah. Over our history, what role has personal appeal played in American political culture?
Well, for 100 years, from the 1830s into the 1930s, personal appeal and party appeal were very closely linked. Even Lincoln, who arguably is the greatest of our presidents, his appeal lay not only in his personality, but in the fact that he was one of the founding members of the Republican Party. And Roosevelt clearly was a mix of personal appeal plus, initially at least, a strong party appeal. Since then, I think that personal appeal, as you would expect in a populist system, has become more and more important. And that candidates who, for instance, today, in some ways the most interesting candidates are Obama and McCain. And both of them really have an appeal that transcends their party affiliation, that doesn't really rely on their party affiliation.
And I've also heard some people, independents and Democrats, also
I can't hear you too well.
I'm sorry. I've also heard independents and some Democrats express interest in Huckabee.
Yes, I mean, and the Ron Paul phenomenon is an interesting, if minor one. So there are all of the old constraints of party loyalty. I mean, many of them are still there, but they don't have the same power that they had in the party Democratic regime in the 19th and early 20th centuries.
You see some of the rough and tumble of political life today echoing that of the first regime in American public life from the 1700s and early 1800s.
I think you're right. They're clearly in that before the party system took over, politics in the 1790s makes the most partisan politics today look pretty mild. And I think that generally speaking, parties have exerted a mollifying effect. Like any profession, the organizations that run the profession tend to moderate the behavior of the membership. Now, clearly, at times in our past, the control of the party has slipped, most dramatically in the 1850s, with disastrous consequences, the Civil War. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, parties have contained or channeled the self-seeking of politicians within lines that could be worked out according to the value system of the parties themselves. A dramatic example of that is to contrast how the conflict over the election of 1876 was handled compared to the very similar problems of 2000. In 1876, the settlement was done by the party leadership, the leaderships of the two parties. They made a deal. Southern blacks were the price of the deal, basically. I mean, the Republicans gave up what was left of their radical Reconstruction policy. Hayes promised to appoint a Democrat as Postmaster General, which gave him access to a lot of patronage, and the Democratic congressional leadership agreed to this, and the Hayes-Tilden crisis over who was elected president was resolved. The courts had very little to do with it. It was a political deal.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, the contrast with our own time, with 2000, is very visible. It's not the parties that worked things out in the 2000 crisis. It was the courts.
Yeah. Well, also, we see a shift between patronage to ideology as being critical.
Yes, well, patronage in the old party sense of the word is almost gone now. The Supreme Court has so contained it that it really is, there's very little old-fashioned patronage. The civil service and the rise of other forms of income for politics has really diminished the significance of patronage. The essence of patronage in the 19th and early 20th century was that it was a way of getting money for campaigns and elections, and also for getting people to do work for the party. Postmaster jobs, and there were tens of thousands of them in the 19th century, were not only to move the mail, but to act as the local party representative, which is why there were such huge turnovers of postmasterships when the party parties changed in control of the government. Mm. Now, that doesn't work anymore, partly because it's not needed. There are other ways of raising money. First, there was, you know, corporate contributions. Today, the main thrust seems to be advocacy groups and the power of the Internet, so that the idea of a really quite marginal candidate like Ron Paul raising more money than many of the major candidates is really something new in American politics.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian Morton Keller. We're talking with him about his new book, America's Three Regimes, A New Political History. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite your questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener now in Geneva, Illinois, on line 4. Hi.
Good afternoon. Good
Hi.
Discussion. I was wondering, a couple questions, comments, kind of. I was wondering, where do you think that the two parties are going to this nowadays? Do you think they're too powerful? Do you think they're bringing everything down? And which one would be the most powerful out of the two?
That's a very good question. And I talk some about it at the end of the book. My view of it is that there's a kind of struggle for dominance over the political system going on today between the parties as traditional organizations that serve the interests of professional politicians and try to get their people elected, and the media and advocacy groups who have other agendas. And you can see the fight going on, I think, in today's Iowa caucus, where the parties who really define the rules of the caucuses have done so in ways that serve their purposes, that is, having their candidates get a crack at getting some of the delegates. I mean, the Democratic rule that you modify the vote in a caucus by to reflect the party vote of that district in the previous election is a good example of that. The media have a different view of it. They've got a view of the caucus as a story that has a certain dramatic quality to it, and that should be, in a sense, strung out as long as it can be until they move to the next primary. I think that what we've been seeing in recent years is the attempt of the parties to secure a stronger position in a world dominated increasingly by mass culture, popular culture, the media, outlets that they can't really control. I think it's very interesting that we've got coming up this year something that really is quite unique in our history, and that is the super primary of February 5th. I think it's quite possible, I wouldn't say it's probable, but it's certainly possible that even that isn't going to resolve things and that it will go down to the conventions for the selection of a candidate, which hasn't happened for more than 50 years in either party. That, in a way, would represent a triumph of the parties or a successful adaptation of the parties to the conditions of political life today. Up to now, in recent years, the party conventions have been sort of empty affairs.
Mm-hmm.
The parties benefit from them because they get a few free days of advertising and of exposure. But almost nobody watches them, so that limits their value. It'll be interesting to see if the parties can regain control over the process by which presidential candidates are selected. And certainly in the past, the presidential convention has been the way in which the party pros were able to exercise that control.
Yeah. What are your thoughts about our current political polarization? Will it continue? Will it moderate?
I incline to the view that over time, and with lots of fits and starts, it will moderate. Because, again, when I look at the whole sweep of American political history, when the polarization gets too keen, the parties suffer and the political process suffers. I would offer three examples of this. The 1850s and the Civil War is the great failure. But then the Goldwater nomination and campaign in 1964, which temporarily all but destroyed the Republican Party. And then the McGovern nomination of the Democrats in 1972. Those two were the two biggest electoral defeats in modern political history. So it seems to me that, plus the constant poll results, would show that most Americans don't really want deeply polarizing politics. And the rise of people like Obama and McCain, who are really talking about a less polarizing politics, suggests that there is a very strong pressure for a more moderate politics. It has run against the nature of issues like Iraq and the 2000 election and the impeachment of Clinton. And obviously, it runs against the interests of advocacy groups and a considerable portion of the media who have a stake in a sharply divided and contentious politics.
Hmm. Let's go back to our listener in Geneva. He has a follow-up question. Line four, hi.
Kind of dropped off there. The other thing I wanted to ask you was, what do you think a third party is going to do? Was there ever one mentioned, in the past, maybe 100 years ago or something? And do you think that the third party issue will ever get legs and run with it? Thank you, guys. Have a great new year.
Okay. Most of American history suggests that the ground rules of the Constitution are such that we're going to have a two-party system. One of the parties was replaced by another one in the 1850s when the Republicans replaced the Whigs. But again, very quickly, after a time of several parties, we reverted to a two-party system. It was just that the Whigs were now the Republicans. Third parties play an important role. They bring up new issues. They influence the major parties. But they never really show much staying power. And they can channel or express a lot of popular discontent. I mean, Ross Perot, who is nobody's idea of the ideal presidential candidate, got about 20% of the vote in 1992. But it went nowhere. I think it left an inheritance of attitudes about government. But and often third parties do that. The populists, for instance, left a substantial inheritance of ideas. But as a party, the ground rules of the Constitution, which say that you really have to have a coalition large enough to win a majority and the winner takes all, makes it almost impossible for a third party to secure a significant foothold in American politics.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another call now. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Two comments, somewhat contradictory comments, but I've been considering for a while that Democrats may end up with some so-called brokered convention that will go all the way to the convention, and it may happen to the Republicans too. But let's say it doesn't, and it's all decided by February, 4th or 5th?
Yeah.
We will have how many months for both parties, particularly the Republicans, of course, to come up with every dirty story possible on the opposing candidate, either way. And I think it's just, ridiculous to have primaries so early in the year and have candidates chosen with such, Well, that's my comment, so.
Well, I think it's a well-observed comment. It certainly is, on the face of it, an imposition on all of us. And it doesn't make the rest of the winter, or the spring, and the summer look very cheery. On the other hand, we got to recognize we now are over 300 million people. It's a third of approaching a third of a billion. It's a huge country, exceedingly complex in its social makeup, in its regions, in its demography. The English can have a two-week election because it's a small and still relatively homogeneous country, although less so. But I think we need a fairly long time to get issues out, to get a good look at candidates, to see what their staying power is. I strongly share your distaste for it coming so early, because we certainly don't need a 9 or 10 month campaign. But again, the problem is partly that there are a lot of interests besides the parties now who have a stake in the story of the presidential election starting early, because it's in many ways the lead story for much of the media. And now they've done Iowa for weeks and weeks, and now they'll do New Hampshire for a while, and then there'll be February 5th. And with the rise of the television, the cable news channels with 24 hours, 7 days a week news demands placed on them, they can't solely rely on murders. The political story becomes a very important one for them. And again, I want to stress that I think that one of the untold stories of politics in our time is the fact that it's not just the parties against each other and the candidates seeking office. It's these other interests who have a big stake in what's going on. Not necessarily a political stake. I think for the media, it's more the economics of the media. And that's part of the reality of our time, and we're going to have to live with it.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign County, line 2. Hi.
A couple of reflections on what you've been saying. Well, one thing I wanted to get your reaction to is you were commenting that patronage is a thing of the past in some ways. In Illinois, retail patronage is still fairly alive and well, we've been discovering. But what I would call wholesale patronage, maybe in some ways, is the military-industrial complex, let's say. I mean, the fact that Halliburton has gotten these huge contracts, I see that as a form of, you know, patronage by another fashion. The politically connected individuals are getting these huge contracts, and it's not like they're getting a job anymore, but they're privatizing whole parts of the government and turning them over, including, you know, defending our Secretary of State, I suppose, in Iraq, with all of as many more, perhaps more military contractors of various sorts in Iraq than there are armed regular forces. The other thing I wanted to take issue with is this commonplace that you said about how people want moderation in some ways. I don't think it's true. I think we're mixing form and content in some ways. I think people are tired of dirty tricks, and people are using things about like blue dresses, stained blue dresses, as an issue, as opposed to really having a hard, tough fight about the issues of the day: taxes, you know, why equity people are taxed at the same rate that their maids are taxed, and things like that. I really don't see that people are not you know, committed to a vigorous defense of their points of views and a vigorous fight in the. I just see that we're, in some sense, the society is depoliticized, so that we're arguing about issues that aren't really related to some of the most fundamental things that are going on in the society. And I'll hang up and listen because.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, those are two good points, and let me respond to them. First, the issue of patronage. It certainly is the case that influence and the use of money in politics is at an all-time high. I mean, we spend well over $1 billion on an election cycle now, and it just keeps going up and up, and things like McCain-Feingold have had no impact at all on it. But I think that it's a little different from the structure of patronage that existed in the party era. We have a military-industrial complex. We also have a welfare education complex. We have advocacy groups that, through the new laws, raise large amounts of money. And indeed, in the last election, the Democratic campaign in Ohio was not run by the party. It was run by MoveOn.org. So there are lots of ways, and of course the Halliburtons are part of this mix, but I think you've got to recognize that the $1 billion or so or more that pours into politics in an election cycle comes from a huge variety of sources, which I think again reflects the idea that this is not so much a party system as it is a populist system, that is, with lots of different interests able to express themselves, exert themselves with a great deal of autonomy. Now, the second point was whether Americans want a polarized politics or not. I would say that if candidates who really push for a narrow and strongly ideological position, and I think two among the more prominent candidates today, the two that best fit that bill are Huckabee and Edwards. If they do exceedingly well in the primaries, then I think your point must be taken has validity. But I must say I don't expect them to do that well, And I think that one of the problems is that people are a little chary of leaders who are, so to speak, too forceful, too contentious and divisive. I think that in America today there is a strong desire for a less divisive politics. I think there are plenty of people on the religious right and the secular left who don't want that. But every indication of the political attitude of the plurality, if not the majority, is that it's centrist more than it is moving toward the two ends of the bell curve.
Let's take one more call now this afternoon. Line 4, a listener in Chicago. Hi.
Thank you. I want to respond to your view on the third party.
I can't hear you.
I wanted to respond to your issue about the third party being non-effective. Well, Ross Perot had his millions to back him, but along came Ralph Nader, who didn't and couldn't even be included in some of the debating process. So the parties that are in power have apparently excluded the chance of even hearing a third party. And the very fact that they're talking about the issues they have today, well, Ralph Nader and others have brought up many of these issues years ago, but because they bash the corporate sector, they're certainly not welcome in that end. And as Herbert Hoover said, the government of business is business. But apart from that third-party issue, I want to ask you a view on the current issue of electoral college, and some of the candidates have espoused disdain over the process of electoral college and its effectiveness. Could you respond to that in some way? Thank you.
Sure. First, on the third parties, it's true that the major parties do everything they can to reduce the influence of the third parties. In the past, when Robert La Follette ran as a third-party candidate in 1924, there were a number of states where he couldn't even get on the ballot. So that's one of the givens of American politics. The major parties are going to try to keep the third parties from becoming too powerful, and I expect that to continue. Now, on the question of the Electoral College, the arguments against it are pretty obvious, and they have a lot of power behind them. The trouble is, or the issue, the reality is, that the ground rules of the Constitution make it almost impossible to pass a constitutional amendment that would end the Electoral College, which is the only way it could be done. Because to do so would involve a very large number of states who benefit politically from the Electoral College voting to get rid of it. And if you or anyone else can figure out how to handle the politics of getting states to go against their self-interest and vote for a constitutional amendment to end the Electoral College, good luck. I would point out also that while sometimes the system fails, and it could be argued that it failed in 2000, it's only a few times in our history. And for the most part, the Electoral College, for all its inequity, is not a dominant force in determining the results of elections.
There, we'll leave it. We're out of time. Morton Keller, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
You're very welcome.
Morton Keller is Spector Professor of History Emeritus at Brandeis University. He is the author most recently of America's Three Regimes, A New Political History. The book looks at the evolution of public life in America from the colonial period to the present. The publisher, Oxford University Press.